Okay. I'm going to speak from up here since you're all pointing in this direction. And I'm going to try to record myself with this.
There you go.
Okay. So I'm very pleased to be here today and look forward to talking with you. And just wanted to give you a flavor for some of the kinds of things that we have been involved with and are working on at the University of York, at the Institute for Effective Education. As you probably know and can tell from accents, I'm not from around here. And I work half-time at Johns Hopkins University, where I've been my entire career before now, and half-time at the University of York. And so I will be talking today about American research and then transitioning into that which we're doing in the UK. Essentially, what we're doing, and I'm speaking, this is not the royal we, this is actually the we that's here and plus a bunch more that's back at the farm. What we're trying to do is something that no one has ever done anywhere, and we're hoping to do it in the UK, which is perhaps the hardest place there is to do this, and that is to try to transform the practice of education into a field that respects evidence, that bases educational policies and practices on evidence of what works. You can, there you go. In essence, what we're trying to do is to have education to do what many other fields did during the 20th century with great difficulty, and still with great difficulty, but really move forward in terms of trying to have practice and policy based on high-quality research and evaluation to put to the test educational programs, practices, policies, and so on in forms that that can give you convincing answers about what works and what doesn't, and then to have those results become critical to policy and practice so that a head teacher, an advisor, a policymaker would look to the evidence before making decisions about what kinds of programs and practices should be used and what kinds of policies should be pursued to help all children to learn. This process is most famously was most famously undergone in medicine, where the development of the FDA in the U.S., the Food and Drug Administration, of NICE in the U.K., and of other things that came before those moved at medicine from a situation in which physicians might consult research or pay attention to it from time to time, but that there was very little respect for the research, and each physician basically made up their own mind about what to pay attention to and what not, to a situation in which there developed standards of evidence for medical treatments, and became more and more important to have that evidence respected in decisions that were made about patient care and about treatments and so on. Not to say that this is perfect or that it's not contentious still to this day, but today in medicine, the linkage between research and practice is much closer than it has ever been in education, and as a result, there is very rapid progress in medicine because anything that is developed that is found to be more effective than that which existed previously is enthusiastically adopted, where in education that process does not take place, and progress in education happens very, very slowly. And I'll talk more about that. But it's not just medicine. Agriculture is another area in which there has been massive change in the 20th century from a situation in which there was lore that was handed down from farmer to farmer, and there were, you know, bits of progress that took place, to a situation in which research became extremely important, and research then, governments helped to, in many countries, helped to disseminate the results of research to farmers. And as a result, once again, not only did the practices of agriculture improve a great deal, but a process of innovation began, because anybody who came up with a better technology, a better seed, a better breed of cattle, could be confident that their innovation would be taken up because people were paying attention to this kind of evidence and acting on it. Engineering, obviously, you know, the technology has changed the world. Technology is something that almost inherently, in most fields, is evaluated and pays attention to advances in evidence. And as a result, there's an innovation cycle in technology that's very, very rapid, where new solutions are constantly pushing out old solutions on the basis of actually doing better, a better job of accomplishing whatever the technology was intended to accomplish. So what we're trying to do is to have the same kind of process happen in education, respecting the differences that there are in education and between education and these other fields, building on strengths that education has as well, but trying to change so that children are receiving the best education possible, that using, you know, with methods, with technology, with textbooks, with professional development programs and other kinds of solutions that have been rigorously tested, found to be effective, found made replicable, and then replaced over time with better and better methods as research identifies more effective approaches. Education reform has been really quite driven by things other than evidence for its entire history. Very much driven by fads, by marketing, you know, salesman comes and tells you this is the greatest thing ever, by politics, you know, minister wakes up one morning and says, hey, let's do such and such, and pretty much such and such is rolled out through the whole country before anybody even thinks to commission an evaluation of it. And you know, people's personal experience, what their mate down in the next school says is a good idea. But the decision-making process in education, it's not to say that it's uninformed by research. There's a lot of research, and people pay some attention to it. But largely the research is used to confirm things you already believe. People often go to the literature after they've already made up their mind what they want to do, and they're looking at the literature to find justification for it, rather than truly looking at research to inform you about what works and what doesn't and what you might want to do in a particular practical circumstance. The result is our famous pendulum of change in education. It's not that education doesn't change. It changes very much, but it changes back and forth around the, you know, around the same fixed point. The pendulum involves, you know, some new idea that comes in with vast enthusiasm and huge political support and got to be done right away. Early adopters find wonderful effects and of something, and or at least they produce wonderful stories. And then the whatever it is, you know, comes in on a grand scale. Some disappointment is noted about how it didn't solve all of the problems, so there's disappointment. At the far front edge of the pendulum, it starts to swing back, and right about the point when the pendulum has gone all the way out and is about this far back, that's when the research starts. Usually by the time the research results appear, the pendulum is three quarters of the way back to where it began in education, because this research takes time, the education change processes moves faster than that, and so as a result, at the end, not only have we not had solid progress, but we may not have learned very much from the process, and the pendulum doesn't advance. there are pendulums that work in areas that do more respect research. In medicine, for example, there are great enthusiasms and the pendulum, but the pendulum moves over time, because what happens is that we keep getting research on the various things that are tried, and many things are found to be ineffective, or other things are found to be effective, and though there are still fads in fashions in medicine, it's much more likely that the pendulum will actually advance. So, we've been doing research initially at Johns Hopkins University and now at the University of York to try to change this. And I'm going to talk about a few areas in which we're working. One of them having to do with evidence-based practice itself and evidence-based policy, the use of experiments in education generally. And then I wanted to give some specific examples about cooperative learning and about a comprehensive reform program for primary schools, mainly, that's called Success for All. So first, let me talk a little bit about cooperative learning. It's an interesting case of what things might look like in a condition of where evidence is important for education. So what is cooperative learning? This cooperative learning is quite familiar to most educators in some form, although mainly people have a rich set of misconceptions about what it is or should be. But people generally know that cooperative learning involves children working in teams, some or pairs or small groups. In our forms of cooperative learning, that we primarily were using teams of four. In the forms that we've been researching and are actually researching right now in the UK, the children work in four-member teams that are heterogeneous. They're high, average, and low-achieving children in each one of the groups. And the team has a goal, which is to make sure that all members of the team have mastered the content that's being presented. So typically, the teacher would teach a lesson in more or less the usual way, hopefully better than the usual way, but you know, in some form, put out the original ideas that are in the lesson. And then children have, in their teams, have an opportunity to work together to try to make sure that every member of the team has mastered that content. Then there are assessments of a variety of types that of the performance of the children that are designed to ensure that there is individual accountability, that where teamwork goes wrong, and about 90% of the time people use teamwork, it does go wrong for this reason. Where teamwork goes wrong is if you set up teams in such a way that one kid can do the work and three kids can watch them do it, that is ineffective, actually not often counterproductive, but definitely ineffective for the obvious reason, that if one kid can do the work and three kids can watch them, then that the kids will do that. Or else there may be a couple kids who are, you know, mixing it up and getting a benefit from the teamwork. But other kids say, well, hey, this is great. This is, you know, I can put my feet up and ignore what's going on now because these other kids are going to do all the work and that's going to be cool. So teamwork cannot be perceived as a way to make things easier for kids. It's got to be perceived as a way to make things more accountable for kids, but also to have the help of their peers. And the way this works, you want to go to the next slide there. So the way this works is that there are team goals, which means that the team is recognized or rewarded or gets, you know, some kind of positive outcome based on for doing well as a team. But the only way to do it well as a team is to have individual accountability, which is to say all members of the team have learned. So just to give you one example of how this works, we use something called random reporter, where the teacher may call on a kid at random, or kids may have a secret number from 1 to 4, and that the teacher would call on a kid not knowing which kid it is and say, okay, this team over here, kid number 3 is going to have to respond to the team. Now, since the teacher doesn't know who kid number 3 is, and the kids know that the teacher doesn't know, this is not, they know that the teacher didn't, you know, cruelly pick out the lowest achieving kid or the high, you know, or what, didn't nicely pick out the highest, they don't know. So, but kid number three has to respond for the team. The kids immediately perceive that kid number three has got to know this. Rather, all the kids have got to know this content, because if one of the kids is going to have to represent the team, then they have to prepare everybody. The same thing can be accomplished by giving kids an individual activity that all have to do, but where they can't help each other, and then the average of the four will be what benefits the team. Or there are many other ways to accomplish it. But the key idea is that the kids perceive that the purpose of the team is to make sure that every member of the team has mastered the material. So the kids are tutoring each other, they're looking over each other's shoulder, they're trying to identify and resolve any misconceptions, they're really engaging with each other about the material. They're not teaching each other from scratch. The teacher's already presented the material, but they are mastering the material together. Okay. Now, the research on cooperative learning is vast. It began in a serious level in the 1970s. There are hundreds and hundreds of studies of cooperative learning throughout the world, even in the UK. What they find over and over and over again is that that you can get improvements in student learning through cooperative learning, but that it depends on having this group goal and individual accountability. This was established pretty well by the end of the 1970s. If you asked researchers who have had any involvement with this at all, they would all say the same thing. People understand this. This has been understood for a very long time. The effects have been seen in grades from 2 through 12, and so primary and secondary schools, in every subject you can possibly imagine. It's also been studied and found to be effective in post-secondary too. And you get lots of other kinds of outcomes as well, intergroup relations, like between students of different ethnic backgrounds, and improved self-esteem, and numerous other kinds of outcomes. Yes?
Can I just jump in here?
And preschool. Sorry.
Yeah, right. I'm just going to tell the answer. That's why I said in preschool. But that wasn't the point I was going to make. I just thought it might be interesting for some of the folks here who are particularly interested in intercultural relations, that back in the late 60s and early 70s, one of the main reasons for implementing and adopting cooperative learning was because of desegregation that was taking place in the U.S. And they were having, you know, black kids and white kids in the same schools, but they weren't interacting, and the race relations weren't getting better. So they devised cooperative learning to try and get people to act, you know, to interact together as equals and to, you know, share the learning and succeed together, and to improve those race relations. So it really did that well.
Right, and the same has been demonstrated in other countries. You know, between Arabs and Jews, between different groups in various countries, even between Yorkists and Lancastrians. But that's another story. that research remains to be done. One thing that was interesting about cooperative learning as well is that this caught on really quite massively, particularly in the English-speaking world. And there was a study in the 1990s in the U.S. that found that 85% of elementary teachers and 68% of secondary teachers claimed to be using cooperative learning on a regular basis. They were lying, but nevertheless, that was an awful lot of teachers. There was a very, very large number of teachers illustrating, very unusual for educational innovations, illustrating that this could be implemented on a grand scale. It was not something that could was just something that could be done in research and not scaled up. What's important for the broader story, though, is that to this day, cooperative learning remains, first off, it remains still seen as an innovation. In other words, not as common practice, number one. And number two, still to this day, if you observe teachers who are using cooperative learning, chances are at least 9 out of 10 that they're using precisely the forms that were found to be ineffective in the research from the 70s to today. Dozens and dozens and dozens of studies find this difference in terms of how you structure the program widely accepted and yet not practiced. this is just one, you know, sort of, you know, from personal history example of how something that is not controversial, that has been very well established, nevertheless has difficulty in becoming common practice in schools on a broad scale, even though all of the kinds of things that people usually complain are impossible about, you know, can't be scaled up, too expensive, too difficult. None of these things happen to be true of cooperative learning, and yet still has a lot of difficulty. In the 1980s, our work at Johns Hopkins took some of the ideas of cooperative learning and began to form them into whole school reform models, first off in individual subjects and later on with all subjects across the school. We developed a program called Cooperative Integrated Reading and Composition, or CIRC, also evaluated many times by many people, found to be very effective. Something called TAI Mathematics, Team Assisted Individualization in Mathematics, that also found to be very effective. This led us to start to put together cooperative learning strategies as well as whole school reform strategies into what we called the Cooperative Elementary School, where we're working in elementary schools, teaching teachers cooperative learning strategies that they could use across the curriculum, and dealing with issues such as children who had special needs and integrating them into the classroom as a whole, building professional development strategies that could be done in the school as a whole, really taking the idea from a classroom innovation to make it into a school level innovation, and found that to be very successful. So we were moving along, and in 1987, we had an opportunity, really a challenge from the Baltimore City Schools. Baltimore City is a large, you know, very impoverished district in a little bit like Manchester, I suppose. You know, with lots of diversity, but, you know, many areas of great poverty. We had a challenge from the superintendent there who said, you know, could you people at Johns Hopkins create something that would help the most impoverished schools in Baltimore, all African American, very low levels of the income, could you help them to succeed from the beginning of their time in elementary school? And so we began to work on something that was considerably beyond what we had done previously, that moved into preschool, kindergarten, beginning reading, and so on, trying to create research-based programs for every part of what a school does. And we reviewed the research at that time and have continued to review it in revising the program over time, basically saying what we're going to do is to design a program, a school, in which each and every element of what the school does has a strong research base. And we'll both contribute to that research base, and as the research moves along, we'll constantly be changing in light of what is being learned by whoever happens to be learning it. Really creating a demonstration, if you will, of what you could do if you could take all of the research there was and distill it into daily practice. And so we created a model that a lot of emphasis on cooperative learning, had a reading approach that used, interestingly, systematic phonics at the very height of whole language or real books in the U.S., Why? We didn't have any bias at this at all, but our review of the literature at that time said synthetic phonics was going to be a lot more effective. So against the advice of nearly everybody, we said we're going to have to use what the research points to. But strong emphasis on comprehension and building language skills and so on. We used tutoring based on largely on the experience of reading recovery, which is now you hear a lot about here. The early research on one-to-one tutoring models was showing, you know, tremendous effects for individual kids who were struggling in reading in year one. So we found a way to make that into a component for those kids who, despite very good instruction in the first place in preschool and kindergarten, first grade, were still having difficulty. Lots of parent involvement. Research also had found the importance of that and how to do it. And a very strong emphasis on high-quality training for teachers, follow-up coaching, a process of really changing what teachers do on a daily basis, that's drawing on a lot of research on how to bring about change at scale. So we did lots of research on this, and many other people around the world did, including here in the UK, where there are 51 experiments that compared experimental and control groups in various places around the world, including a large-scale cluster randomized experiment in the U.S. that involved 35 schools all over the U.S., in which schools were randomly assigned to use Success for All or not, and found throughout all of these consistent positive effects, not in every study, but you know, and certainly on average, consistent positive effects of this way of working. And it would be astonishing if that were not the case, because remember, each and every component is also well researched and known to be effective from similar kinds of high quality research. There was a study that found long-term effects following kids who'd been in the first set of Baltimore schools into the beginning of beginning of high school, into the end of eighth grade. And we've created a form of the program to work in middle schools, which are the early years of secondary, and now working in senior high schools beyond that. But sort of a step-by-step development process leading to high-quality implementation of programs that have strong basis in evidence. You can go on to the next one. Some key things to point out about Success for All that I think are important in this broader notion of evidence-based reform. One is that staffs, whole school staffs, vote to take on Success for All. We try to avoid situations in which it is imposed on teachers. This is really critical. For quality implementation, what we want to have is staffs that reviewed the program, that went out and saw it, that read the research, that looked at the website, that thought it through, and adopted the program as a conscious choice. I think all programs should do this to the extent possible. It gives you an opportunity to then not have teachers feel as though this is being stuffed down their throat, but that they made an active choice and that they're genuinely committed to putting their energy and enthusiasm into high-quality, intelligent implementation of something rather than have something that comes down from Whitehall and you've got to do it. Using a variety of implementation strategies and some federal money at the end of the 90s in the Clinton administration, we were able to expand to about 1,200 schools in the U.S., actually considerably, about 1,600 schools. And we had absolute confirmation of how effective this was by the fact that the Bush administration immediately stamped it out. So it must have been great. But the 1,200 schools have remained using the program under funding other than the funding that had existed for this kind of thing in the Clinton administration. We have about 100 schools we're working with in the UK as well, all over the UK. All of them are high poverty schools in a wide variety of kinds of circumstances. One thing that's interesting about, you know, the educational innovation is rather flashy, and you know, things come in, great enthusiasm, and then they go out pretty soon. The average Success for All schools use the program for 7 years. And they don't, after a certain point, there are schools that drop the program because they can't afford it or what have you, but the great majority of them don't, and it tends to become the core of what the school is about. So even after the original teachers who voted for it, the original principal or head teacher brought it in, are all gone, it's just what the school does. And so new teachers get socialized to the norms of the school and get told on the day that they're interviewed that this is just what the school does. And if you like that, that's wonderful. If you're willing to be trained in it, that's good. And if you're not, there are a lot of other schools around. So that's an important part of ongoing maintenance of innovation as well. There were other, in the Clinton administration, there were a number of other whole school reform models as well, some of which also had good evidence of effectiveness, a lot of which didn't. but we learned a lot about the difference between those that worked and those that didn't. But there were other models that took different approaches to curriculum, that took different approaches to dissemination and to training and so on, but also had a number of commonalities in terms of whole school change, quite extensive professional development, use of elements with some basis in research, and so on. And so it's not just success for all. There are lots of demonstrations, not lots, but a handful of good demonstrations that you can bring about quite significant change in student outcomes doing whole school change. At its peak, there were somewhere between 6,000 and 9,000 schools in the U.S. that were using one or another of these various whole school reform models, not just ours. So, what does this mean now for evidence-based reform more generally? It means our experience, and that of many others, says that it is possible to take programs that were developed, researched, found to be effective, and scale them up to work at a serious level with high quality so that they're still getting the good results that were obtained in the early research. But there are several things that have to happen in order for, at the policy level, in order for this change to become serious and accepted as a routine in policy. First off, you have to have a lot of proven programs. If you accept the idea that evidence-based reform is a good thing, but you only have a program or two, then you're basically saying, you're having the government once again saying, well, you've got to use this program or that program, and nobody likes that. What you want to have is a variety of programs, that some of which are just touch on an individual subject area, some of which might just be preschool, or might just be secondary, or might just be English, or might just be science, or what have you. But you need to have a good core of proven programs, and that list in the U.S. is pretty small. In the U.K., it's tiny. And so that's a serious problem in terms of getting this kind of thing going if you were going from dead stop today. Second, you need a lot of reviews of research. You need to be able to take the research and use consistent, fair, scientifically justifiable standards to review it and communicate it to educators, so that you're not telling people, if you want to use effective programs, go sit in the library for a week and try to figure out what the hell the research tells you. So somebody has to be able to take that research and synthesize it in some form to make it readily available. The UK has the EPI Center that's trying in this direction. The US has the What Works Clearinghouse. We have something that's both US and UK that's called the Best Evidence Encyclopedia, or the BEE. That's attempting to take the best evidence, use consistent, open, easily replicable kinds of review strategies to be able to communicate to educators what the research says. And one of the things about education is that it is very much driven by government, and government has to be willing to support the idea of using things with good evidence. Government is so influential in education that even just talking about it would be enormously helpful. If Ofsted came and told schools, hey, I'm not terribly upset to see that you're using programs and practices with strong evidence of effectiveness, that would be hugely influential in this country because people are quaking about Ofsted. But things like the programs during the Clinton administration that were providing actual money to schools to use programs that fit in a certain category that were supposed to have good evidence of effectiveness, demonstrates that even fairly modest amounts of resource left to schools, so the schools are making their own choices about what they want to do or whether they don't want to do anything at all, but in which there are resources available, encouragement available to use programs and practices with strong evidence of effectiveness. And then, to feed into a constant development of new programs and new practices that hopefully are expand the reach of proven programs or that replace some of the best that we have today with something even better. So what would you have to do? You'd have to, in the UK in particular, if you were going to adopt a policy of this kind, the first thing you'd have to do is to have somebody invest a lot in the evaluation of existing programs. The programs that are most widely used, the reading programs, math programs, science programs, and so on, that exist most widely in the UK, not one of them has been evaluated in an experiment of any kind, I can assure you, because I've been reviewing this stuff. Some of them have been evaluated in extremely small pilot studies. There are some good studies of programs for struggling students, but in terms of basic reading programs, math programs, science programs, they have never been evaluated. We have no idea. Why should somebody choose this program versus something else? You can use any basis you like. There's no evidence that that one is more effective than anything else. That could be readily done, though, in a fairly short number of years to evaluate some things that already exist and that look particularly promising. Second strategy might be to import programs or adapt successful programs from other countries. There are a number of things in the U.S., from Israel, from Belgium, from Netherlands, from other countries that have developed programs that do have strong evidence of effectiveness that could be readily adapted or fairly directly adopted in the UK and then evaluated in this country according to standards here and to the context of the UK. It would be important to create to sponsor the creation of new programs and new practices, obviously, and then subject those to the same kind of scrutiny and evaluation. How should they be evaluated? I write a research methods text, and the first page of my research methods text is just like the first page of everybody's research methods text. It says, the methods should follow the question. Now, there are many kinds of questions in education, that are all of which are perfectly legitimate, and for which there are different methods. But when you're asking a question, like, if I use program X instead of program Z, what are the outcomes likely to be? The appropriate comparison is going to be an experiment. It's going to, if an experiment asks, answers just that kind of question. If I say I want to improve performance on key stage 2 assessments, then you've almost described your research design by saying, I want to see whether this program versus common practice or this program versus that program is more effective in terms of improving my key stage 2 or my much lamented key stage 3 or GCSE or whatever it might be, or to improve some other measure that's an accepted measure of outcomes in a given subject area. Once you've said that that's your goal, what you've just described is something that is most effectively evaluated in an experiment. A well-matched experiment is not so bad. A randomized experiment is better because it removes the possibility of selection bias, and we can talk about that later if you want to get into it. But that's these are the kinds of things that you'd have to do if you were in charge of education in the UK, that you'd have to be considering all at the same time to try to get the concept of evidence-based reform into policy and practice on a regular basis. So let me just say a little bit more about what I mean by all these things. First, reviews of research. You would need to have reviews of research that use scientifically valid procedures, that have consistent standards in terms of, if it's experiments you're looking at, then there was a control group. The control group and the experimental group were well matched. The measure was a measure that wasn't inherent to the experimental treatment, that wasn't something that only the experimental kids would see. And that was real in the sense that it was not just a 3-day lab experiment, but was used over an extended period of time in real schools on a scale, hopefully on a as large a scale as possible. So you could set those standards and then consistently review research from the past and new research that's appearing. Do things meet those standards or don't they? And have a very careful vetting of the research so that you can fairly consistently conclude what has strong evidence, what does not. And then summarize that evidence in a way that makes it easy for educators to get a hold of. You have here, if you go out and buy a car, you look in which magazine, right? Which or what? You look in which or what? We use Consumer Reports, which is the same kind of concept. If you look in there, you know that people have somebody has subjected various cars to a consistent set of standards, whatever those standards might be, and then communicated them in a very simple way. Consumer Reports has a little full circle that's red if it's good, and a half red circle if it's not quite so good, and an open circle if it's kind of average, and a half black circle if it's pretty bad, and a full black circle if it's an American-made car. or a Citroën. So you have to have something like that says, all right, well, here's all the details, and has the backup information so that somebody who wants to know the detail can go and find it. But that doesn't require that educators have to become researchers. They have to become critical consumers of research and help them with providing the whatever levels of summaries are necessary to help them to make good decisions for their children. Okay, next here. There you go. I mentioned that we have something called the Best Evidence Encyclopedia, or the BEE, that we're working on in this at both York and at Johns Hopkins. This is the U.S. version of the BEE. Actually, it's been replaced with a new homepage, so it wouldn't look just like this, but you get the basic idea. So showing in elementary mathematics, if you were looking for, you know, what would be a good thing to use in primary math, and you were interested in U.S. programs, then it would show you both an educator summary and a full report. The full report is about 120 pages with all detail that you would expect in a scientific document. So you can find out, where did these results come from? Is this just the guy's opinion, or is it really something for real? The educator summary is very short and to the point. So for example, an educator summary would include a blank. Here we are. Okay, so this is a listing of programs with strong evidence of effectiveness from that U.S. Best Evidence Encyclopedia. Here's things with moderate evidence of effectiveness, and there would be definitions of what these things mean in terms of numbers of studies, the consistency of the effects, the sample size, and a number of other factors that would determine which of these would be. And this is just the first page. There's also limited evidence of effectiveness. There are always some programs that have been pretty well convincingly proven to be ineffective. There was very good research that repeatedly finds no differences. And a very long list, very, very long list of things that have never been evaluated at all. And so if you look into the B, which is www.bestevidence.org.uk, the new one. No, it's not. UK is not up yet. So .org. Then you can see what this looks like, and you'll see this kind of result as the endpoint in each of these with different programs listed. Each of them, then, the ones that meet at least limited, we give the website for that program. So one of the ones that keeps coming up very well is a program called PAL, for Peer-Assisted Learning Strategies, from Vanderbilt in the U.S. So if you clicked on that, then you would take you to the PALS website, and the PALS would have the opportunity to explain what their program is about. We would have a summary of it, but you'd really want to go to the website so that an educator who learned how to do this would basically be looking at things that have all been vetted and found to be effective, and then say, okay, well, within those that found to be effective, what really fits my situation? You know, they may find that some of these things are too expensive, or they're too difficult, or they only exist in the U.S., or you know, not everything is going to be for every school. But you want to begin with which ones of them actually deliver the goods, that actually improve student learning. Now, evidence-based policies, what would they look like? I mentioned before, you'd need to have a lot of support for research and development, not just building of theory, but actual development of promising approaches and practices. And then ultimately, you know, going through a process of piloting and small-scale studies, and eventually things that really look promising, doing high-quality evaluations of those programs that would include, ideally, both random assignment to conditions, mixed methods, so that you're getting an idea of what was actually implemented and what it meant to be in that program in a given school, but good measures that everybody could agree really represent the goal of education in that subject area. And then I mentioned earlier that you'd want to have incentives. or encouragement by government to use programs that had been evaluated in this form and found to be effective. Now, what would be the consequences if you had a situation like this? Obviously, if we had the good evidence on the best programs and practices that existed today, then people might gravitate toward those with the better evidence and leave aside those with evidence of ineffectiveness or lack of evidence, and that would be better for children today. I would argue that that's not the most important outcome. The most important outcome is that it would begin a process, the process that we see in technology and agriculture and medicine, of progressive improvement over time that education utterly lacks throughout the world. A process in which anybody, any company, any university, any government agency that looks at an area and says, you know, we really need better things in this area, anybody who then develops something, evaluated it carefully, found it to be effective, that met standards of quality of evaluation, would know that people would use this. People would take advantage of whatever it was that you found. So that you would be constantly having new things coming out on a much more rapid scale that are not just new ideas that are cool because they're new, but things that have actually been shown to be effective and coming out all the time. Several years ago, my father needed a heart valve replaced. And his doctor said, you know, development on heart valves is going so fast that the longer you can keep your current heart valve, the more the research will improve and the more the devices will improve. And so you should hold out as long as you can with your current valve so that you're taking advantage of the pace of research. And it, you know, he managed to do that for 4 or 5 years, I think, and his position was right. There were all kinds of things that were in the pipeline that were much better than that which would have existed if he had taken the heart valve right away. In education, just imagine telling a year one kid, listen, we don't have very good reading programs for you now, but if you could just hold on for 5 years, we'll have something much better soon. Not only would it be a bad, really bad idea, but we wouldn't have much better reading programs right now. Change in education moves very, very slowly because the whole research and development process doesn't have an incentive to it at the end point to say effective things are going to actually be used. Instead, you get a publication or two and you move on to something else. I guess that's it. So in that case, I'll stop and take your questions.
Thank you very much. I have a question.